This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here on this Monday. Marco Werman has the day off. We begin today's program in Brazil, where former President Jair Bolsonaro is under house arrest for allegedly plotting to overturn the 2022 election. His trial starts next week, and if he is found guilty, he could face up to 43 years in prison. Bolsonaro is ideologically aligned with President Trump, who has imposed tariffs and sanctioned Brazilian judges to try to help his ally. The courts are standing firm. But the whole situation is putting pressure on the country's fledgling democracy. The world's Tibi Saizeya is in Brazil to get perspectives from the people most affected, Brazilians themselves.
Every Sunday, São Paulo's main avenue, Avenida Paulista, turns into a car-free zone for bikes, scooters, and pedestrians. It's a space where people from all walks of life come together and where I stopped to ask some people what they think about the country's political moment. I ask if they think former President Jair Bolsonaro should be convicted. I'm certain he'll be convicted, said Mauricio de Melo Ribeiro. Not just him, but everyone who tried to plot a coup against Brazilian democracy, he said.
Neste momento, nós estamos com uma democracia em construção.
Our democracy is still a work in progress, he said. And it's really important that we keep pushing to make it stronger. He says he would totally support Bolsonaro's conviction. Recent polls show that most Brazilians agree with him. 55% say Bolsonaro's trial is fair, and 39% believe he shouldn't be judged at all. The trial has also sparked conversations about whose voices matter in Brazil's democracy. On Avenida Paulista, a group of practitioners of Candomblé religion gathers for a public ceremony. Candomblé is an Afro-Brazilian religion that has faced a lot of stigma, especially under Bolsonaro.
Luciana Bispo.
Luciana Bispo is a black woman and a follower of the faith.
Todas as pessoas que cometem infração, elas são responsabilizadas por isso.
She says all people who break the law should be held accountable, and Bolsonaro shouldn't be anything different.
Eu vi vários retrocessos de políticas que estavam garantidas e que...
She says in Brazil there's been a setback in terms of policies to advance racial equity. Many of these policies vanished under Bolsonaro's leadership.
O povo preto há séculos vem lutando para ser livre, vem lutando para ser reconhecido.
For centuries, Bispo says, black people have been struggling to gain freedom and recognition in this country. For her, this trial is about rebuilding trust in a democracy that includes everyone. But not all on Avenida Paulista see the trial as fair. I spoke with two men wearing Brazil's soccer jersey, now closely linked to Bolsonaro, and they share strong opinions in his defense.
Muitas pessoas culpam Bolsonaro, né? Não tem culpa.
Many people blame Bolsonaro, but he's not guilty, says Edson Preto.
Não vi como golpe de Estado. Foi uma manifestação que saiu de controle.
I didn't see that as a coup. It was a protest that went out of control, he says.
A gente quer liberdade, a gente quer democracia, a gente quer nossos direitos, né?
Preto says he believes in freedom and democracy, but that the courts have gone too far, punishing Bolsonaro for his beliefs, not for his actions. His distrust runs deep toward political institutions and media as a whole. The divide playing out on Avenida Paulista reflects a national debate. The story mirrors what happened in the U.S. Both Bolsonaro and Trump lost re-election. Both questioned the result. Both inspired violent attacks on government buildings by their supporters. But there is a big difference. Trump is back in power, and Bolsonaro is facing decades in prison. Claudio Gonçalves Cuoto is a Brazilian political scientist.
I think that Bolsonaro's conviction is especially important for Brazil because we have a very long history in Brazil of institutional breakdown. We had many examples of military intervention breaking democracy, and Bolsonaro always was a clear supporter of this experience of military dictatorship in Brazil.
He says the outcome of Bolsonaro's trial could set an important precedent for Brazilian institutions and for the world.
And so when such a person that attempted to break democracy in Brazil is punished, well, we give a message for the future that if someone now attempts to break the rules, to break democracy in Brazil, they cannot escape from that.
Trump is trying to save his political ally by imposing high tariffs and sanctioning Brazilian officials. But the pressure is not working. The popularity of Brazil's president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is rising. Bolsonaro's base is fracturing, and Brazil's Supreme Court is moving ahead. Legal experts say the case against Bolsonaro is so strong that he's likely to be convicted, and the country's democratic institutions to hold. For The World, I'm Tibisay Sea, São Paulo, Brazil.
In Japan, a desalination plant is now being powered in part by its own waste product, very salty water. The osmotic power plant relies on fresh water and salt water, and importantly, osmosis, to produce electricity. The power generator is the first of its kind in Japan and just the second one in the world. We asked Bruce Logan to break down the pros and cons of osmotic power. He's a professor of environmental engineering at Penn State.
When you have fresh water and salty water that are separated by a membrane. And what happens is the fresh water wants to push through that membrane into the salt water. When it does that, that salt water becomes pressurized. And then we can use that pressurized water to drive a water turbine. It's like water flowing over a dam at that point. You have water that can turn that turbine and make electricity.
This is osmosis happening, harnessing the power of osmosis, which is why this is called osmotic power.
Right.
And this power plant in Japan, it is, as I mentioned, only the second osmotic power plant in the world. How significant is it in thinking about this as a potential renewable energy source?
Well, it's an energy source, but at that particular plant, they're actually using a brine from a desalination plant. So they desalinate water. They have to do something with that salty brine that's left over, but it's really salty now, much more salty than seawater. When they bring that into contact with the fresh water, they get even more power back than they would from seawater. But it's not sustainable because you have to desalinate the water, which takes energy.
You're saying it's not a sustainable approach because more energy went into the desalination plant than you are getting out of the power plant that uses the waste product of the desalination plant?
That is correct.
Okay. But this is being explored as a sustainable energy option. Can you tell me what those explorations look like and how close we are to maybe getting this as a sustainable energy source?
Well, there are lots of very salty water sources, much more salty than seawater, that exist in salt domes and in certain very salty seas, for example. So in those cases, the water's there and you could use it and you can make that energy. But you don't often have very salty water next to very fresh water. And so that's a challenge for making this more widespread.
Because you would have to kind of pump these two water sources together, which requires energy, in order for the water sources to produce energy.
Right. You'd end up using up all the energy you were going to make just to pump the water to where you needed it.
So is this plant in Japan seen as kind of a proof of concept that it could, though, be a useful technique for, as we said, extracting energy out of a waste product?
Yes, absolutely. A plant like this really can show the economics of the overall process. How much did it cost to build the plant? How much pumping do they need? How long does it last? All those things cannot be evaluated unless you build a big plant like this.
Mm. Can you tell me about some of the other pilot projects that have looked at this technology?
There have been other pilot studies using salt brines, naturally occurring salt brines, or salt brines from industrial production. These have also shown that you can make electricity, but they've never been commercialized due to the economic costs.
So is this a question of more development needs to happen to create, I don't know, more efficient pumps or something like that? And then this might be a promising technology, or
or is this kind of a technology that's played its course?
Well, I don't do research in it anymore because electricity is pretty cheap, especially from photovoltaics and wind energy. And the amount of capital investment to extract that energy, even if you could do it profitably, is pretty high. So I don't see it being that viable, except in very unusual circumstances. That could be at brine from a desal plant or a brine pool or something like that. But certainly it would not be a widespread method of generating electricity.
It sounded like you were saying earlier, electricity is cheap now in photovoltaics, so solar power produces pretty cheap electricity. So maybe that is the thing to just pursue building up rather than investing in investigating these other techniques.
Yeah. I mean, there's one other issue here, and that is the concept of energy storage.
Yeah.
We really need good ways to store, especially electricity, right? When the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. So on a plant such as this, the electricity might get very expensive at night because the sun's not shining. Or the wind stops blowing and natural gas, say, prices are very high. There'll be points where maybe you can just use the salty water in that pool with some fresh water when electricity is very expensive, and then you can really make a good profit on it. So it may be not so much electricity production continuously, but as a method of storing that salt until a time when you can use it to make that electricity.
Bruce Logan, professor of environmental engineering at Penn State. We were talking about a new osmotic power plant online in Japan that makes use of salty wastewater from a desalination plant. An athletic event in Lithuania this weekend drew competitors you might not expect. Corgis. Yes, the dog breed that might not immediately bring to mind feats of athleticism. But thousands of people gathered in a big park in the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius, to watch the dogs compete at the highest level. There was a time trial sprint, a contest for the mightiest voice. There were costume challenges. Dovile Balusovaite is the corgi race organizer.
This year we had 110 corgis. Some of them came without registration as well, so we don't know the exact number.
Welsh corgis are widely known for two things, being short and stubby and having a connection to the royal family. But it turns out they are also passionate racers. Teams from around Europe and the U.S. showed up for the event, including James Ferguson from Seattle. His dog was in the costume event.
He'll be a hula girl in this competition, and then he'll be in the race. And he was in here last year, but didn't do so well.
Other costumed corgis came dressed as Batman, airplanes, and bunny rabbits. The winning costume was a factory. The corgi strutting up in that getup was named Amigo. He came festooned with tiny chimneys.
Just watching him is magical.
The fastest corgi was Mango, who is back for his second attempt this year.
Last year, we didn't manage to end the race perfectly. We had a really good training. We have trained every day. But this year we decided we just go without training just to participate.
The International Corgi Contest got its start when COVID-19 regulations were relaxed in 2020, back when people and apparently dogs were hungry for more connection. And those little corgi legs, still going strong. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. People who came to the U.S. legally during the Biden administration from a handful of unstable authoritarian countries are now immediately deportable. That's because the Trump administration revoked the humanitarian program that brought them to the U.S. Now these immigrants are in a state of limbo. About 500,000 people find themselves in this situation, including a journalist who'd been targeted for her work in Nicaragua before fleeing to the U.S. Immigration editor Taiki Hendricks with KQED in San Francisco caught up with her after her status changed.
When I arrive at her sunny apartment in Concord, the journalist has just moved in. She has no furniture yet, so we sit on the carpet. She and her lawyer ask me to use only her first initial, E. That's because she fears what the Nicaraguan government could do to her if she's deported. E is in her 40s and a mother of two. She tells me she decided in high school to become a journalist and went on to a career in TV, radio, and newspapers.
Me da la oportunidad de darle voz al que no tiene voz. También de pronto.
She says it's work she believes in, giving voice to the voiceless and holding people in power accountable.
Dentro de los límites.
But in Nicaragua, it became increasingly risky to hold the government of President Daniel Ortega accountable.
Existieron en Nicaragua medios de comunicación que sí decíamos la verdad. Todo eso expropiado, cerrado.
The government took over news outlets or shut them down. Journalists were locked up on false charges. Ortega first became president as part of the leftist Sandinista revolution that overthrew a four-decade dictatorship in 1979. When he was voted out, he stepped down. But after winning re-election in 2006, Ortega tightened his grip on power. He has jailed and expelled political opponents and made his wife co-president. And this summer, a former general who became a critic was assassinated in Costa Rica. In spite of the risk, E stayed. She teamed up with other journalists to secretly report and publish news. Then, she says, they learned there was an enemies list.
Si la orden es que a esta persona o a mí como periodista me van a encarcelar y estoy en una lista, yo ya voy a estar encarcelada.
They notified the people on it so they could escape. Get out, run, she would tell them.
Aquí lo único que es tienes que salir corriendo.
Then, in late 2023, E found out she was targeted.
Y mi fuente me dijo, corre, estás en la lista.
My source told me, run, you are on the list. E says she left her family and went into hiding. She applied to the U.S. for temporary humanitarian parole, a program the Biden administration set up to channel tens of thousands of people fleeing Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, and Haiti away from the border and into the U.S. lawfully. E says she was one of more than 40 journalists who escaped Nicaragua last year. A few colleagues stayed. They told her, I have nothing to fear.
Tengo amigos que quisieron enfrentar la justicia. Dicen, yo no tengo nada que temer. Yo me quedo.
She tells me they are now in prison. After she left, E says, police trying to locate her beat up a family member. Eventually, early last year, E's parole was approved, and she flew to Florida with a 2-year work permit and a chance to seek asylum.
Cuando venimos a este país, pensábamos que ya íbamos a estar bien.
She says when she got to the U.S., she touched the ground and thought, thank God, I'm in a welcoming place and I can start over. But it hasn't been so simple.
E's case is a very great example for why we even had the program.
That's Rina Aria, an immigration lawyer with Jewish Family and Community Services of the East Bay. She's taken E's case pro bono.
She came in legally at the United States, vetted her, ran her fingerprints, they stamped her passport.
In Florida, E found work she loved, doing public relations for nonprofits. And she applied for humanitarian parole for her children, who were still in Nicaragua. But the day President Donald Trump took office, he ended that program, and her kids' applications became void.
Ese día yo lloré, no tenés idea, lloré todo el día, todo el día.
She says when she found out, she cried the entire day. Soon after, she saw federal agents rounding up immigrants on a street near her office. She had thought parole protected her. Now she felt hunted again. Friends in California told her she'd be safer here, in a state with some sanctuary protections.
Así que vine aquí otra vez con una mano atrás y otra adelante, sin techo, sin nada, ni trabajo.
So she uprooted once more, coming to the Bay Area with nothing. She slept on friends' couches until she found this apartment in Concord and a supermarket job to pay the bills while she looks for work in her field. Advocates sued the Trump administration to preserve the humanitarian parole that protected E and 500,000 others. But in late spring, the Supreme Court ruled the government could start revoking it while the case plays out. Sure enough, E, like others, got a letter canceling her parole and her work permit.
It's a cruel measure. You know, these people are not criminals.
That's Boris Munoz, a Venezuelan journalist in exile who's now a U.S. citizen and has worked at the New York Times and taught at UC Berkeley.
In particular, for journalists, it's crucial because they cannot live in their countries.
He's watched similar repression unfold in Venezuela and Nicaragua. And now, he says, the expats who found refuge here are again at risk as the Trump administration threatens to deport them.
I'm very worried about my colleagues, you know, that suddenly found themselves in a limbo after thinking they were being protected by a government that stands for democracy.
For E, that irony is overshadowed by simple fear.
Si tú me hablas y me preguntas si yo tengo miedo de volver a mi país.
She says, if you ask me if I'm afraid to go back to my country, the answer is yes. I've seen people who were tortured. It's very difficult.
Es muy difícil. Muy difícil.
With the help of her lawyer, Rina Aria, E has applied for asylum, so it's unlikely she'll be deported anytime soon. But Aria says the promise of protection has been broken.
That's fundamentally unfair. It's not how our immigration system has ever worked. And it's a very scary door to open.
For now, E keeps going. She'll furnish the apartment, and she hopes to one day bring her children here. But it could take years. Meanwhile, she's committed to working for a democratic society, whether for Nicaragua or here in the U.S.
Que yo sé que todavía tengo algo que dar a la sociedad. Y sea la sociedad en mi país, o sea la sociedad aquí.
That's the work I've always done, she says. And one day, I will be doing it again. For The World, I'm Taiki Hendricks.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. South Korea's new president met with President Trump at the White House today. It was their first in-person meeting, and Yi Jae-myung went out of his way to flatter the American president. Yi said President Trump is making America great again. He complimented the new decor in the Oval Office. And on South Korea's toughest security challenge, dealing with nuclear-armed North Korea, Yi said through an interpreter that Trump is the only one who could be a peacemaker on the issue.
So if you become the peacemaker, then I will assist you by being a pacemaker.
That's good. We can do big progress, I think, with North Korea.
But just before Yi arrived at the White House, President Trump fired off a social media post threatening not to do business with South Korea. The World's Matthew Bell talks us through the summit, starting with that post on Truth Social.
So it was a short post that said, quote, "What is going on in South Korea? It seems like a purge or revolution. We can't have that and do business there," unquote. Seems kind of ominous, but during the joint news conference that took place between Yi and Trump, Trump was asked about this. He sort of evaded the question, and the atmosphere there was very warm, jovial. The men both had great things to say about each other, and they both talked about making the U.S.-South Korea alliance even greater.
I imagine, though, that that post, that Truth Social post, was not what President Yi was hoping to see right before this meeting with Donald Trump, which was his first time meeting him in person. What was at stake for South Korea heading into this summit?
There's a lot at stake for the South Korean government, and partly that's because Yi Jae-myung is playing catch-up. For the first several months of this year, the legal process, the political process was playing out in South Korea after the impeachment of the previous president. So essentially, there was no administration, there was no government in South Korea to sort of establish an early working relationship with the Trump administration as it got up to speed. There are things that are just always huge on South Korea's agenda when it comes to the alliance with the U.S. National security is probably the biggest one. There are still 28,000 American troops in South Korea. But now there are questions about President Trump's commitment to keeping those troop levels. He has also said that he wants South Korea to foot more of the bill for the U.S. military presence there.
Matthew, American troops have been based in South Korea for decades, since the Korean War in the 1950s. What do you think the bottom line is for President Yi when it comes to U.S. forces there?
So generally in South Korea, conservative politicians, like the previous president, tend to play up the security alliance with the U.S., while liberal politicians, and this is where President Yi Jae-myung comes from, are more willing to be critical of that relationship. But what Yi Jae-myung has done is really sort of tack to the center. When he was campaigning earlier this year, ahead of that snap election, he talked about the importance of the security cooperation with the United States. And that was definitely the message today. Warm, friendly, solid relationship with Donald Trump, with the United States.
The South Korean president also visited Japan over the weekend on the way to Washington. How does that meeting or how does that relationship factor into the U.S.-Korea relationship?
President Trump today said that was great. He talked about how the U.S., Japan, and South Korea can all improve their relationship. And he mentioned it in context of North Korea. So that seemed to go over really well with President Trump.
What about trade with the U.S.? What was President Yi hoping to get out of this meeting on trade?
When the two presidents took questions from reporters today, we didn't get a lot of detail about this. These negotiations are still ongoing. South Korea is not facing the steepest tariffs on exports to the U.S., but they are significant at 15%. The White House is apparently looking for big South Korean investments in the U.S. economy. There's talk about potential cooperation with semiconductors, computer chips, with battery technology, with shipbuilding. President Trump himself has talked a lot about boosting U.S.-South Korean cooperation on shipbuilding to compete with China, which is the biggest shipbuilder in the world.
When two world leaders meet for the first time, you kind of always wonder about the personal chemistry between them, how they're going to get along on a personal level. What do we know about Trump and Yi in terms of their own potential or personalities when we think about them working together?
So their backgrounds in some ways couldn't be more different. Yi Jae-myung grew up in a poor family. He quit school as a teenager. He went and worked in a factory. He went on to become a human rights lawyer and then a left-wing politician. And interestingly, the two men have things in common. Like Trump, President Yi has faced legal challenges in court on corruption and making false statements. He's also survived an assassination attempt. Mm. That was early last year. And apparently, when the two men first got on the phone ahead of today's summit, they bonded over this shared experience of attempted assassination.
Very small club they belong to. The World's Matthew Bell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Debate over the use of hotels to house asylum seekers has reached a fever pitch in the UK. A high court there just ruled to evict residents of a small-town hotel where asylum seekers had been living. Now several local councils say they are preparing their own legal challenges in hopes of getting more of these so-called asylum hotels shut down. Critics say that objections to these hotels are about race, with asylum seekers in the UK predominantly coming from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Iran. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
In mid-July, Epping, a sleepy English town known for its local forest and its transport museum, became a flashpoint for anti-migrant protests. The demonstrations kicked off after reports emerged that an asylum seeker staying in one of the town's hotels had been charged with sexual assault. Some of the marchers shouted support for national far-right extremist Tommy Robinson. There were lots of counter-protesters too. The Epping Hotel houses 140 asylum seekers, and in late July, the local council called on the government to shut it down. Last week, a High Court in London ruled in the council's favour, granting a temporary injunction that would see all the asylum seekers forced out by mid-September. A small group of protesters, draped in England flags, gathered outside the hotel, poured champagne into white plastic cups, and celebrated. Within hours, the leader of nearby Broxbourne Council said she planned to take legal action too.
My issue, as I said, is the groups of men that are arriving here on the boats that will probably not receive their right to stay in this country, but they're not deported. So they're walking around the streets and we do not know who is amongst us in the community.
Corina Gander, the Conservative Council leader, tells me around 300 asylum seekers are staying in a hotel in her area that's already attracted protests. Gander says she understands why some residents are angry.
The people that are protesting are being classed as far right, but they are people that are protesting to protect the borders. And I think Britain is now saying, you know, we've had enough now.
The asylum seekers put pressure on our medical clinics and our housing waiting lists, she says. But where will they go, I ask, if they're forced out of the local hotel?
Ultimately, there is a decision that the Home Office and the government are going to have to come to.
Around 30,000 asylum seekers are being housed in hotels across Britain, and the rising wave of protests has left many feeling frightened.
Scary, like, that's the only word to describe it, scary.
Scary, says Khadar Mohammed, who's staying at the Epping Hotel. He spoke to ITV News.
A lot of guys took some beating, you know, in the beginning. It's scary.
The Populist Reform Party, led by Nigel Farage, is advising all 12 councils under its control to launch legal challenges. Even a number of Labour-led councils say they're now seeking legal advice. Refugee rights groups say the issue is being used by all parties to score political points.
Every single party is pointing fingers at other parties. You can't do this, you can't do that.
Steve Smith, the CEO of one of those groups, Care for Calais. He says there is one thing everyone agrees on, and that's that hotels are not the answer. More than 20 years ago, Britain had a similar number of asylum seekers arriving, he says, but with one key difference.
There wasn't the manic hysteria in the press. There wasn't the same emotion around the whole situation. You know, people were just integrated into communities. Their claims went through. They were either accepted or they were rejected. And we moved forward.
The Labour government has talked incessantly about cutting down on the number of migrants arriving in Britain, Smith says. And now it's backed itself into a corner.
None of the solutions are going to be easy for the government, unfortunately, because the current government has, if anything, contributed to the demonisation of asylum seekers.
The British government says it will appeal last week's High Court ruling and says it plans to overhaul the asylum appeals process, which could lead to more deportations. But that's unlikely to stop the protests. And it leaves one big question unanswered. If the hotels close, then where will the asylum seekers go? For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Venezuelans rushed out by the thousands to join a civilian militia over the weekend. That was in response to a call from President Nicolas Maduro for citizens to support the Venezuelan government against the United States. Tension between the two countries has been escalating and ratcheted up dramatically when the U.S. sent warships to the southern Caribbean Sea in recent weeks. David Smildy is an expert in Venezuelan politics with us from Tulane University. He said President Trump's decision to send ships to Venezuela is most likely symbolic.
It's probably just an effort to kind of try to scare Nicolas Maduro and sort of satisfy the, you know, the pressures he gets from legislators from South Florida. But, you know, there's always a possibility that he could launch some kind of strikes.
So these two countries have been at odds for some time. What is causing this inflection point of tension between the U.S. and Venezuela right now?
Well, what we're hearing right now from Donald Trump is the fact that, you know, he is serious about combating drug cartels, and that Nicolas Maduro is the head of the Cartel de los Soles. If you remember back in February, the Trump administration deported 200 and some Venezuelan young men, saying they were part of this Tren de Aragua, and they used something called the Alien Enemies Act. For this, this is something from the 18th century that allows the United States to remove people from the U.S. without actual due process. And so they used this, saying that this was a Tren de Aragua, that Nicolas Maduro was involved with Tren de Aragua. And so this is, you know, is something that is in the background of this. But, you know, it's a narrative that has very little support. The whole idea of Cartel de los Soles is something that was sort of created by journalists in Venezuela 30 years ago as sort of a shorthand to indicate the fact that there were military officials involved in drug trafficking. But there's nothing that could be called a cartel.
So at its very basic level, the Trump administration has said it is deploying ships off the coast of Venezuela to try to stop a drug trade happening off of the coast, correct?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, really, even the vessels that they have are not the type that you would use for drug interdiction. So they're not really useful for that purpose.
And the cartel that you are talking about that President Trump has said Maduro is the head of, you're saying is not actually a cartel. It is kind of a framework that people use to think about how the military is involved with the drug trade.
Yeah, I mean, I think the militia is really kind of a sideshow. I think the whole cartel story is a sideshow as well.
So if those two things are the sideshows, what do you think is actually at the root of what is happening, both off the coast of Venezuela and within Venezuela?
Well, within Venezuela, you know, what is happening, what's been happening over the past year is that the government stole a presidential election in a very obscene way. And so it's in a weak position. A lot of people, including the Venezuelan opposition that won that election, you know, have been trying to generate international intervention in Venezuela. That is sort of their most, you know, vibrant hope to be able to take power. Mm-hmm. So there's that going on from within Venezuela. I think in the United States, I think this has to do, you know, with theater, with political theater. No, I don't think it has to do with drugs. I also think it has to do with this Alien Enemies Act. Basically, the Supreme Court has never actually decided on that. They decided some procedural issues, but they didn't decide whether it was legal or constitutional for the U.S. to actually use that without there being an actual war against Venezuela. And so if the United States, if the Trump administration can say, well, look, we have these warships, or maybe we even attacked Venezuela, we are at war with Venezuela, or we can use this Alien Enemy Act to, you know, deport Venezuelans without actual, you know, hearings.
So you think that amassing warships off the coast of Venezuela might be an effort to give legal cover to the administration to deport more people back to Venezuela?
Yeah, I think it is, in part, is a way of giving legal cover to the use of the Alien Enemies Act. You know, if they can show that they are actually in a conflict with Venezuela, well, then that makes that plausible. I think part of the issue is that Nicolas Maduro is so discredited that basically you can say anything. You can say anything about Maduro, and, you know, it's hard to contest. Mm. If you sort of say, well, you know, that's wrong, well, then you immediately sound like a Maduro supporter. And so he's just in the situation, or the Venezuelan situation, that people will believe anything that you say about them. No.
Maduro is, of course, considered an authoritarian leader. He has clung to power in Venezuela for more than a decade, crushing the opposition. Is this standoff with the U.S. doing anything for how he's seen at home?
Well, I mean, I think it is something that he can use for mobilization, sort of patriotic mobilization of his coalition and many others. And there's many Venezuelans who, even if they don't like this government, don't like the idea of U.S. intervention, don't like the idea of violation of their sovereignty. This does not help. I mean, it does not help. You know, I think that this is a net negative for people that are living in Venezuela. And it really sort of facilitates Maduro's power within Venezuela.
Yesterday, civil society groups said the government released opposition leaders from prison. The government had denied that they were in prison in the first place. What is the government doing here? Is this a sign of progress?
Well, it's a sign of progress. Anytime there are political prisoners that are released, but, you know, depending on how you count it, there's between 300 and 800 political prisoners still in Venezuela. So it's very, very modest progress, you know. And I don't give too much credence to this because it's the type of thing that happens every couple of months. You know, the government will sort of release some political prisoners.
What will you be watching for as this situation develops, as the domestic militia grows in Venezuela and as there are warships off the coast?
I don't think that the domestic militia is actually, you know, relevant to this picture. But Donald Trump has shown that he hates boots on the ground. He doesn't like regime change initiatives that involve long occupations. He does, though, like air power and missiles. And so, you know, I will be looking for, on the one hand, are they getting these destroyers, with these missiles in position for that? And then I think most relevant is Venezuela's air defense systems. They have the best air defense system in the region, you know, outside the United States.
David Smildy is a professor at Tulane University explaining the tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the waning days of summer, many of us are trying desperately to squeeze in one more vacation. And if a road trip off the beaten path is on your agenda, this next story might strike a nerve. It's about a close call in the wilderness, as remembered by journalist Akshab Ghidradas. He lives in Washington now, but back in India, his love for traveling far from home earned him a nickname, as he explained when recounting this tale for GBH. Stories from the Stage.
I grew up in Bombay, India, on the West Coast. Being able to go to a new place outside India was enchanting. Getting immersed in the historic tales, the cultural fables, I enjoyed it. To my friends, I'd seen more places outside India than in India. So I became known as NRI, Non-Reliable Indian. Which is true. Even till today, I regret to say I haven't seen the Taj Mahal, but I've seen the Great Wall of China. So naturally, when this friend of mine said, we're going to take a road trip, I said, yes. It didn't matter that, you know, I didn't know 4 out of the 5 people on the trip. It didn't matter. I didn't know the logistics. It didn't even matter. I didn't know how to ride a motorbike because half the journey was on motorbikes. I just said, new place, why not? We're going to Manali, a place in the northern state of Himachal Pradesh. This was hometown to the Dalai Lama and other Tibetan monks. It epitomized tranquility of sorts. So I had spent 48 hours on an uncomfortable train journey from Bombay to Delhi, another 10 hours from Delhi to Manali, escaping 120-degree heat of summer. But I'm like, hey, if you have to get to heaven, you have to live a hard life. And when I got to Manali, it was heaven. It was beautiful mountains, mystic rivers, not the one in Boston, forests, tranquility all around. And then I realized, India has 1.25 billion people. But yet we are minority in this town. That's a hard thing to achieve. There were more Israelis in the town than Indians. I couldn't read half the signs in Hebrew, and I felt illiterate for that moment. I had to ask. I asked this Israeli backpacker, why are there so many of you here? Don't get me wrong. I'm glad tourism works for everyone. You learn more about a country. It's great for the economy. But it seems half of Tel Aviv has come here. What's up? And he says, you don't realize how good you guys have it. 3 years on the battle line, fighting for your life. Manali is heaven on earth. The food's full of spice. The weather's nice. The grass is greener on the other side. In his case, the grass was greener on the other side. Because Manali was sort of like India's Amsterdam. Each cafe had its various samples. Bob Marley would have a hard choice choosing between cafes. But of course, our main journey was going up on motorbikes to one of the Himalayan mountains. It was our own Everest summit. This is the part I dreaded. I held on to my friend tightly as I sat on back. As our tires went over stones, they fell to a bottomless abyss, reminding us that death is just one wrong turn away. The snow-capped mountains in summer reminded us of the Game of Thrones-like winter that was approaching. We were nervous, but I couldn't say anything. I had to pretend to be strong. Half an hour ago, I was laughed at for ordering bruschettas at a local restaurant. Country bumpkins, I thought, and they make me sound like the idiot. We stopped at a lake for a lovely photo shoot. My friends got out for what I like to call a contemplative smoke. The guy I was riding with perhaps smoked something a little too different. How do I know that? Because as he got on the motorbike, he forgot one tiny detail. I wasn't on it before he sped off. So here I was, in the middle of this gorgeous lake setting. No one in sight. Don't panic, I said. You're just in the middle of nowhere, with no one in sight, no cell phone connectivity, and it's getting dark. Next thing I said was, help, 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 as my echo rang through the mountains. Ooh, car approaching. I started waving like a crazy hitchhiker. Then I'm like, oh, not too crazy. You want them to stop for you. The car stopped, but before I could get in, my rider came back rushing, remembering he had left something valuable behind. Now, if I thought this was the worst of the journey, I was sadly mistaken. It was nightfall, we didn't have a map, and we had lost sense of where the camp was. And in India, you ask for directions like this. This is 2007, pre-Google Maps. Take two left turns, take a right turn, there'll be a shopkeeper over there, maybe he knows the way. That's how directions went. So we're like, okay, let's erect a tent in the middle of nowhere. I'm being very generous by calling it a tent. In reality, if this was a geometry class, this is a badly drawn isosceles triangle held together by a single rod. We were afraid it would fall on us and smother us in our sleep. We had no food, limited water. The only thing keeping us warm was this bottle of rum. We reminded ourselves we hadn't eaten dinner, but there were howls out in the woods, which reminded me that something else wanted to eat dinner. And as I was falling asleep, I heard a voice. Come up! We're waiting. Oh, goodness me. Horror side camp stories are only fun when you're on your own bed. This time I heard a woman's voice. Come up, food's ready. Like, oh goodness me. I woke up wondering if I was having hallucinations. Two other friends did the same. Unless hallucinations were telepathic, we pretty much were hearing the same voice. We got out of our tent. A couple of villagers were holding lanterns. They ushered. We followed. We had no choice. We entered the slums, some of the most dilapidated homes. But on the floor, they had plates lined up with rice and lentils. We were shocked. We looked at them saying, however did you? They looked at our puzzled faces. They're like, every month we see a couple of idiot urban boys who think they can come out here, camp in the wild, and think they can survive. It's our duty to feed you guys. Well, we couldn't complain. Six of us in our ravenous state ate up all the food. We reached for our wallets to offer them something for the day's rations. They said, no way. It's our humility. It's our hospitality. We cannot take money from you. Just then I realized, I learned the profound meaning of hospitality, the rich values of hospitality, from people completely poor and destitute. Just then, these people are not on any landmarks to visit in India, but yet they are what make India rich, the innate value of humanity, the intrinsic value of compassion. And as I walked out from that slum, as I walked back down to my tent, maybe this trip did serve as a metaphor. As you climb an uphill task, when you're stranded in the middle of nowhere and the lights go out, help can come from the unlikeliest of sources, even if it is from people who need your help most of the time. Thank you.
Akshab Gidradas shared this travel experience on Stories from the Stage, produced by our partners at World TV. You can hear more stories at worldchannel.org. We've all been told about the value of a good night's sleep. Good for your health, good for your mood. That kind of respite is difficult to find for people living through near constant gunfire, shelling, and air raid sirens. Tomorrow on the show, the search for a night of peace and quiet in Gaza and Ukraine. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can also find us on YouTube at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Dodie and Billy Crockett, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Lynn and Bruce Dayton. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.